So I was thinking before we get to ByteDance, TikTok, maybe Douyin as well. I think it's best. I think it's best to start with who Zhang Yiming is. Is that fair? Is that a fair place to start?
That's good.
Can you, can you please maybe give us some context as to who Zhang Yiming is? Why are we talking about him?
So Zhang Yimin is one of the founders of ByteDance, and he has an interesting career. He worked for multinational companies. He worked for domestic startups in China. And then the first significant app that they produce was an app with jokes. And, jokes is sometimes tricky in the Chinese environment. And so that app eventually got shot down. And then the company had much more success with Toutiao, which was an app for news. And the idea is actually really brilliant because in China, most of the news is government controlled. There's a lot of state presence in the media. And the idea for Toutiao was that it would sort of find these unusual news stories that maybe are not widely reported, maybe they're far away from the population centers. And so it became a really important source of news for many people, which matters a little bit for the eventual development of TikTok, because the way the algorithm works, the way you find these unusual news stories, that had relevance for Toutiao, obviously, but it also had relevance for Douyin, the domestic version of TikTok, and then TikTok itself.
If I'm not wrong, I think Mr. Yiming left. So he, if I'm not wrong, he had started a company and he was working on that company, and then he just realized he left the company that he founded to found another company, right? If I'm not wrong.
That's right. So, and also his current involvement, as you probably know, there's a lot of tensions between technology companies and the leaders at technology companies and the Chinese government that often has a particular view of the role of media and the role of what tech leaders should and shouldn't do. And so he's one of the people who eventually took sort of a back seat in the organization. And then his co-founder, actually, who, or maybe someone who was very early in the company, took over and was part of the is now part of the leadership team of ByteDance.
Like, just to go back, in the sense that I found that really interesting that he left the company that he founded to found another company, in the sense that when he like I found it very interesting in the sense that when you're already working on something and then you find another idea which you think is an even better idea, and to leave the idea that you're working on and then to pursue something new and to take a bet on that, I just thought that was very interesting. And I thought it takes like a different kind of courage to kind of maybe pursue things like that. At least I wouldn't be able to do it. So I found that pretty interesting. The Toutiao app, I mean, so I think he, I think the timing aspect of this is also pretty interesting, right? In the sense that I think around 2012, it's a, I think around 2012, I think deep learning was, I think machine learning or deep learning was starting to kind of evolve. And I think, you know, these kind of computer vision algorithms or you know, the rise of deep learning was just beginning to like kind of start. Do you think that played like a big role in the way, like the timing aspect in terms of like when he was starting these companies with like maybe recommendation as like the core part of like the USP of the companies that he was starting? And maybe previously it was, even if somebody had the idea, the technology was just not there to kind of deliver on that product. Is that fair to
Yeah, I
say,
think that's
or?
right. And then I think it's both the timing and but also the country where sort of this ability to then find content that is unusual, that is not present in all the media outlets, that's particularly important in China, right? That would be much less important in, say, a US or European media landscape where there is a cacophony of conversations at any point in time, where there's lots and lots of media outlets that specialize in many, many ways. And so when you think about the way you would like to train an algorithm so that it finds these unusual pieces of content, that of course is much more relevant in the business context of China compared to many other contexts. So it's both the timing that the technology was right, but also the country that had a particular demand for news. that wasn't government sanctions, news that was maybe more interesting than what your local television station or your local newspaper would provide.
Right. I think in your report you mentioned that the amount of state media or concentrated, like news by media companies, is significantly less than, like, let's say, people who produce independent news. Is that accurate or?
Yeah, so there's two things going on here. One is that both the central government, but also the state governments and many local governments, they're very active on social media in general. And so you have many stories that are posted by local government officials. And generally speaking, my sense is that Chinese government officials are much better at this than, say, European or American officials, so that they, you know, sort of mimic the tone, mimic the type of content. And they have a pretty significant presence on Douyin, the domestic version of TikTok. Now, of course, overall, it's the media system is dominated by government sources and is dominated by government channels. But the social media part is really interesting because there, of course, these media systems are open. So you and I could post, or someone else who lives in China could post. But also the local governments have seen that this is a really effective communication channel. And so they use it for all kinds of purposes.
I was kind of shocked that, and I think this is also in your report, that I think about 40% of all content, like 40% of the posts, at least, is dominated by, what is that, state media, state-funded posts, or it's the government that is active in the app, if I'm not wrong. So that was like a mind-blowingly large number, I thought. 40%
Yes, and don't think this is sort of like, you know, the missive from the prime minister's office. This is often very local, you know, local news about something that happens in your town or maybe a project that the local government is working on. So it's used as a communication channel. But what's really fabulous to see is how the format that is used, sort of like, you know, often sprinkled with humor or often brought forward in a more sort of casual way than you might expect from a government report. So it's both, there is of course the presence of the central government, but actually to get to the 40%, what's really, really important that you have this massive involvement of local governments.
Right. So it's not like the way I was thinking about when you mentioned, when I heard the 40% number, and when I read that it was the state officials who were like kind of posting, I was thinking about these boring videos where maybe it's just there's this guy who's reading out stuff. It is not. It's very subtle, right? Like I.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So of course, this is, I think, where the algorithm plays a big role, right? If you're a government official and you upload a really boring video that is no one going to watch, it's not going to get any traction. It will not show up in anyone's feed, and so, in part, what you see the these local governments' ability to sort of speak the language of TikTok and emulate the content, that has to do with, if you want to reach people, you better have something that is attractive. You better have something that is appealing. Otherwise, the algorithm is just not going to play along.
Understood. Should we move on to ByteDance? Like, you know, maybe do you want to set the stage for like what is ByteDance and you know, what does it do?
Yeah, so ByteDance is the owner of Douyin, first and foremost. That's, in particular, from a business perspective, that is the most important business. It's the business that is most profitable, where they generate revenue not only through advertising, which is very common on social media, obviously, but also they have built a really impressive e-commerce business that now serves as sort of the foundation or the cornerstone of the business. And then they developed a version of Douyin for outside China, TikTok. And I think it was in particular the merger between TikTok and Musical.ly that ended up being really important, because Musical.ly had gotten quite a bit of traction in the United States. Musical.ly, as the name suggests, had a lot to do with the kind of music that young people like and the dances that young people like. And so it was really sort of the machine learning AI aspects of TikTok taken together with insights into what Western culture is about, the kinds of music that people like, and so on and so on. This combination proved super successful. So proved that very, very powerful. I'm guessing that TikTok would not have reached the scale that it has, or at least not as quickly, if it hadn't been for the merger of these two companies that brought really both very different capabilities, but very important capabilities if you set out to build a new social media platform.
If I'm not wrong, Musical.ly is not an American company, right? It's a Chinese company, if I'm not wrong.
So Musical.ly was Shanghai based, but it, as is so often the case with social media, you know, you're a little bit in control where it takes off and when it takes off, but not completely. Because the way these things grow, we often describe this as network effects. The more people you know who are on a particular network, the more interesting it becomes to also be on the same network. And as a result, it's almost like supercharging the growth of a company. But it can happen in pretty random and interesting ways that are sometimes really baffling even to the management team. I give you an older example that is basically illustrates the same dynamics. Friendster was one of the really important social networks before Facebook. And Friendster was really prominent and was like very popular in North America. But Friendster, for reasons that are, you know, mildly random, was also very, very popular in Indonesia. So once Facebook grew up and, you know, posed serious competition to Friendster basically ended up being mostly an Indonesian network. Did the company do anything to cater to Indonesians in particular? No, they didn't. It was just an open network. And then, you know, if you and your friends and a couple of acquaintances, all of a sudden everyone's on Friendster, your incentive to also be on Friendster are now increasing. And as a result, you get this really interesting phenomenon of how particular social networks penetrate particular countries, even though this may or may not have been the attention of the management team. And Musical.ly, although it was a Shanghai-based Chinese company, it did find this amazing success in North America.
I can think of another example in terms of network effects, which is I think Orkut was another platform which I think was extremely popular in India and Brazil, but I think it was not at all popular in Europe, and I think in the US also I don't think it did very well at all.
That's right. And you know, the management team didn't go out and say, "Oh, let's build something that's going to be really amazing in India and in Brazil." No, it's in the presence of these network effects, because growth feeds on itself. If you have a particular base, a particular foundation, it might well be that all of a sudden you become dominant, or at least you become an important presence in a market that you hadn't even really thought about.
Right. So now that we're talking about Douyin, we're talking about TikTok, we touched upon Musical.ly. I want to just maybe understand or try to gauge the difference between social media before TikTok, in the sense that, like, if I think about apps like TikTok, and if I include the current revolution as well, maybe let's say Reels and YouTube Shorts, so it's very dominant as video first, and I don't know if you can consider that social media per se, but I think before that, it was mostly your chronological feed, where you would only get posts from your family or from people that you know. Is there a differentiation? Is it fair to draw that? Do you think that it's such a big difference that we can call something social media pre TikTok and social media post TikTok? Is there a big difference in terms of the way we interact with social media?
So I think TikTok really brought three changes at one and the same time. The first is the one that you already alluded to. Social media was mostly dominated by images, by photos, I think particularly true for Instagram. And then, you know, you replace the photos with video. So that's a first difference. The earlier networks were intensely social, in that you would only see or mostly see content of people you had a connection with. Again, like on Instagram, you would basically see the posts of friends, people you follow, acquaintances you might have. TikTok is a little social in the sense that you can follow a particular producer, but there's no guarantee that you will see mostly content. In fact, in most feeds, for most people, they see lots and lots of content that is produced by people they don't know, they don't have a relationship with. And so even though there are modes of interaction, sort of the social element, TikTok has really de-emphasized. It's not that important. In fact, it's not super important for your experience. And then the last thing that I would point out, and this is mostly a contrast to YouTube, was in particular in the early days, incredibly short videos, right? So that was also, you know, and it's interesting because if you go on YouTube, even if it's the simplest explanation, it's going to take 7.5 minutes because the advertising model basically lends itself to making these really long videos. And so to have a platform that was video focused and on entertainment focused, was less social, and then had content that was just like incredibly short. That was, I think, the three dimensions along which TikTok really presented something that just wasn't available in the market before.
I want to go back to Douyin for a second. How has so TikTok has been extremely popular, and I think so it's banned in India, so I'm not able to access TikTok. I have it on my phone, and sometimes I use it via VPN, but it's not available natively. But anyways, going back to Douyin, I'm just curious about did Douyin also get a similar reception like TikTok, in the sense, was it like widely popular as soon as it launched? And could you also like in the sense that like the number of users per se, does it have like an extremely large user base? Like,
So exactly the same kinds of dynamics where it becomes very popular very quickly. And in fact, I mean, now we're thinking about Douyin and TikTok as really two very separate platforms. But that is more or less the influence of politics on how these platforms had to evolve. So in the early days, if you went on TikTok, you would see lots and lots of Chinese content because, you know, the same kind of content that is popular in the West was popular in China. And so there was really, it's sort of in an amazing way, you got a glimpse of what Chinese social media is like, even though you were not yourself in China. And many of the things that have enduring popularity, like the challenges on TikTok or sometimes the funny sketches that people do, many of those formats are actually formats that originated in China and then found appeal on TikTok. And, you know, it was in the early days, it was a wild mix of people in China and people in the West producing content for this new platform. And so over time, as political pressure has increased, I think TikTok, just like many other Chinese companies, are now trying to make sure that they distance that, at least in their Western version, that they distance themselves from China because they fear the political pressure that comes from being somehow perceived to be close to the Chinese government.
But also, I think it'll be difficult for, for a single version of Douyin to kind of go global, in the sense that I think, in the sense that, like, since there is a lot of state-sponsored content on Douyin, it'll be very difficult, I think, to tailor the algorithm in that sense to a global audience as well, no? I mean, is that fair? Or?
I mean, to the extent, so we can talk about how the algorithm works probably in a little while, but to the extent that the algorithm has an important role in determining what you see, I don't think it would be all that challenging to figure out that probably someone who lives in Kansas is not that interested in, say, local news from Dalian or some other city in China. And so I don't know that that's such a big deal, sorting out the content. But of course, the regulatory rules around social media, what you can and what you cannot do, and lots of the way the business actually works. So for instance, one main difference at this point in time is that TikTok is almost exclusively advertising finance. So its e-commerce efforts are in the very early days. while Douyin is an amazing e-commerce machine in ways that TikTok is just not. And so
it also gives... Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So it's just when you see the opportunities to buy things on TikTok, they come along every now and then, but they're not that common. In China, the e-commerce part of Douyin is built out really significant and is an amazing part of the platform. A little bit like the changes that you have saw in Instagram, where, you know, sort of the direct involvement of brands on Instagram has increased in importance over time. And in that sense, you should almost, I'm guessing that looking at Douyin today gives you a little bit of a glimpse where TikTok is going to go, what TikTok will look like in the future.
When you mentioned that, I was there when TikTok became extremely popular. So I have seen the kind of rise that TikTok, I mean, it was like, I remember like my friends like coming to me and just with so much of excitement and, you know, sharing this app and, you know, there were these people who were dancing and, you know, overnight, a lot of people became influencers quickly overnight. And it was all the buzz and, you know, people were making dance videos, which was not the norm at all. I mean, it was very odd for people to, you know, make videos on the street per se. It was not common. It was not something that you get to see. But after TikTok really exploded all the way. So in that sense, when I'm thinking about this, it feels like, I think it feels like Twitter in the sense that I think somebody, there was a quote about Twitter that Twitter was not an invention, but an idea to be discovered. So I also feel very similarly to this TikTok or Douyin in the sense that it was just waiting for the right person to discover the idea. But so that is one way of looking at it. But if I can just contrast that to Vine, which was already present, maybe I think in 2015, 2014, and it had seen some traction, but never really took off as well as TikTok did. So I'm drawing these two parallels, and maybe you can comment on that. How are you thinking about it?
Yeah, so one exhibit with data that you have in the case that I've written on TikTok is really fascinating to me. And it basically breaks down the age structure. And so, you know, not surprisingly, it's mostly young people who are on TikTok. You see how the age is sort of increases over time so that, you know, in the beginning, it's all just like incredibly young people. And now it's, you know, middle-aged people and so on and so on. But maybe the most interesting part is that TikTok has this amazing competitive advantage among young women. Young women flock to TikTok in ways that they frankly don't engage these days with Instagram. And so one question is like, what is that? Like, what, why is it that both, if you look at very young women, but also then women in the early 20s or so, is like TikTok is just completely dominant relative to everyone else. And one interpretation is that what we're seeing is the increasing sort of mental health issues that are associated with the super polished life that is presented on Instagram. You know, on Instagram, everybody looks always perfect. You're going to the most amazing restaurants. Today, you're in Dubai. Tomorrow, you're in South Africa. A week later, you drink champagne in New York. It's really sort of like, it's anxiety-inducing in ways that I don't think we really understood when social media first came along. And in the meantime, of course, we have like really serious academic evidence also that the mental health issues that are caused by these hyper-polished social platforms, these mental health issues are really serious, and it's a really big social problem. TikTok comes along, and it has none of that. It's authentic in a way that is really quite spectacular and amazing. I mean, people, half the people who shoot videos, they look like they rolled out of bed 30 seconds ago. And, you know, when you, like, one of the funny things to compare is like when you see people cook on TikTok, you see all the things that go wrong when you cook. You don't have the right ingredients, and then the thing doesn't boil or doesn't do what, like, it's a way of sharing what with each other, the moments in our lives, that is so much more authentic than what we had on Instagram. And I think that's part of the appeal that you then see in the demographic penetration that the platform has relative to everyone else. And I would say many other social media didn't really create a home for young women that felt much more comfortable than what social media had offered so far.
Is it fair to say, that like a lot of people, at least to themselves, they were getting tired of all the filters and of all the presentation that you had to put up for a single post and all the minor edits that you had to do to look perfect. And here comes this new thing that, you know, you don't really have to care so much. So it's a relief per se, you know,
I don't think it's so much about the tools, right? Because TikTok is pretty good at providing tools, say video editing tools, filters, and so on and so on. So that is maybe not so different. But the filters that people often use on TikTok, they're silly. I mean, they're not, you know, I don't know, if you don't have perfect skin, like the filter is not first and foremost designed to make you look perfect. The filters are often designed to transport humor, to make you look funny, to, in that sense, it's much more, I think it's much closer in spirit to Snap, which had a little bit that same irreverence also. There, of course, coupled with the vanishing messages that allowed a form of expression that was, felt a little more risky, felt a little more, you know, you could do crazy things that you probably wouldn't do on Instagram, but you could do those on Snap because, you know, the message disappeared. But that's actually a very interesting observation to me, at least, that the one social media platform that allowed more authentic expression did it in the context of messages that would disappear, as if there was something wrong with, you know, being particularly goofy or particularly funny or you don't look your best and so on and so on. So sort of saying, yeah, you know, there is, you can share that with your friends, but you probably don't want a memento of that for the rest of your days. And then TikTok comes along and it's just very different. Also because you have no control over what you see in the first place, or you have very limited control over what you see in the first place. So if I admire a particular actress or a particular actor, you know, I can of course use the explore page to find content that's related to that actor, but sort of in native mode, if I just fire up the app and I get an endless stream of videos, I don't really control much of that experience.
And I think that's a huge plus, right? Like for me, actually, that's a huge relief that, and you know, it may be lazy, but like I feel, like sometimes I generally do feel stressed when I look at my YouTube homepage and there are like 4 or 5 videos which are equally interesting. And I'm just like, now I have to make up my mind whether what, like, do I want to watch something informative or do I want to watch something relaxing? So, but if I go on TikTok or, you know, in India, if you go on Reels, the decision is kind of already made for you and you're just taking it easy. And, you know, I feel that's a huge plus.
And that's a general change in the web overall, right? When the web first came along, it was all about choice. So why was Amazon so amazing? Well, Amazon was so amazing because it had so many more books than your local bookstore could ever carry. And so the first iteration of the web you should think about is mostly giving like unprecedented choice, like an amazing selection. So we get Amazon, we get Walmart, we get all of these platforms. And now I think we're in a phase where sort of both the cost of that selection, but also, you know, finding it so amazing that there are, I don't even know how many books there are on Amazon, probably millions and millions of books. Like no one is really that amazed by this particular fact that all of this information is available right now. And so right now, I think we're in a serious mode of curation. So selection, I think, has been, in many, many ways, has been replaced by curation. And there, of course, we go back to your earlier observation that part of that has to do with how technology happens to evolve, that we now have machine learning and artificial intelligence in ways that can make much better predictions about what you like or what you don't like. But it's also that we've gotten a little tired of, you know, the incredible selection that is really hard, that is really hard to deal with. I don't know if you know, Stitch Fix is a business here in the United States that essentially curates mostly clothing for professional women. And the idea is that you don't have to worry about, you know, going out to the stores and finding the right thing to wear and does it look good on you and so on and so on. They're using machine learning and some human interaction to basically send you the kind of clothing that is very close to what you might buy, or that if it's not very close, you think, oh, I never really knew I look great in pink. And now it turns out I do look great in pink, that kind of a thing. So curation is just a really big, it has a really big moment in the development of the web, and TikTok and the way it's presenting content is part of that.
Do you think this is the, like the, do you think we are at the final step in the sense that?
Never, I think. If you push me and ask me like, what's the next thing? I think that would be a long and complicated conversation. But I do think there was, of course, something amazing about, you know, the incredible selection that you had. Like, it's interesting. I recently had a conversation with executives where we were thinking about the role of generative AI in travel services. And the group was basically split down right in the middle. So some people said, oh, if generative AI works really well, I'm just going to tell it to tomorrow, I want to fly from London to Rome, and these are my favorite airlines, and you book the whole thing for me. I don't want anything to do with it because I know you're doing it really, really well. And then almost an equally big group said, no, that's like the worst idea ever. In part, what, like all the links that you see on a typical Google page, in part what that does is it gives you a little bit an overview over what's available and gives you a little bit of sense of, you know, how could I fly? What are the different airlines? What are the different prices maybe? And so to delegate all of that to basically and a bot that then books my flight seemed completely out of the question for the second group. But what was particularly interesting to me is like it was a very different intuition about how much trust you can have into artificial intelligence and the role of human interaction or the role of human choice in these kinds of environments. And I think the truth is because people have not been very good at building actual products. There's obviously a lot of machine learning models, but we don't really have all that many products, so we don't really know. But the prior intuitions, at least, couldn't be more different from one another.
Right. Like, I mean, one of the reasons why I asked you if this was like the final point is in the sense, like, at least for this form factor of like a phone or like a touchscreen phone, like, I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, obviously, if I knew and if I had to build it, I don't know. It just seems like I don't know what else could be done. But parallel to that, I'm also...
It'll be on your glasses next, right?
Right, but for this form factor, like
to the extent that it has to live on the phone.
Yeah, yeah. I just feel we've reached. Let me finish this. Yeah. I feel we've reached the end, but I don't know. But innovation is all about.
Exactly.
Giving you something completely unexpected. On like the form factor, I'm curious if you think, when I look at YouTube. And you know, this goes back to the curation part. How I was talking about the YouTube homepage is just a collection of videos, and you have to scroll through them and select. Are you surprised that the same model has, if I'm not wrong, I think since the day they launched YouTube, it's just consistently for the past 15 or odd years, it's consistently remained the same. Like, they've obviously integrated more machine learning in the way they've made changes to the way they recommend content, and maybe obviously some UI stuff has obviously been there's definitely been a lot of changes, and YouTube Studio, etc., a lot of changes. Yeah. But essentially, the web page of delivering content has stayed exactly the same. Are you surprised by it, or do you think not a big deal?
I think you're only surprised by it if you generally buy into the rhetoric that Silicon Valley and tech companies are incredibly innovative. They're not. I mean, think about the changes on Facebook. Doesn't Facebook look ancient at this point in time? Like it really has not changed in fundamental ways in so long. And I think the same is true for Google Search. You know, Google Search is now it's moved a little bit, maybe in this past year as a result of generative AI. But other than that, like the Google Search pace basically stayed the same forever. Has Gmail really evolved in interesting? No. So somehow, because these companies have a really fabulous, great new idea that then changes the world, you know, the way Google has changed the world or the way Facebook has changed the world, we sort of associate them with they're really innovative and they're doing a million. I think it's true. They're doing a million things. But in so many tech products, actually, the pace of progress is incredibly slow. Like these products, they just like what you said for YouTube. I think it's true for so many other tech products. But these products, you know, they work well, they're incredibly profitable, and as a result, the companies basically don't touch them. And that's, I think, the story of YouTube, right? It's gotten to be so dominant in long-form video. You'd be hard-pressed to find another site that can rival it. And as a result, you know, what are your incentives to change a winning game? Not all that big. And as a result, we get very little innovation.
So I think it's fair to say, like, I think there's a saying that if it's not broke, don't fix it. So I think most companies seem to be operating under that. Like, you know, it's generating a lot of money. It's doing pretty well. Let's not fuck with it. I mean, let's not. Yeah. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that sounds exactly right. And then, of course, you get external pressure. And then the other thing that is interesting. So if you took any sort of strategy class at any business school on the planet, like the main thing that you would walk away is that ultimately profitability is all driven by differences. If you want to capture a fraction of the value that your company created, you somehow have to do something that is differentiated. And the second thing that's really interesting about tech is that in tech, everybody imitates everyone else. So, you know, look at what happens to Instagram when TikTok comes along. Look at what happens to YouTube. When TikTok comes along, it's this fast emulation of whatever seems to be the new thing. Maybe recognizing that the ability that the following new thing comes from inside the company is not that those chances are not that big. And as a result, you know, your best opportunity is to at least stay current and at least stay relevant by copying what's out there already. And by the way, it's not only, I mean, it's true for TikTok as well. Like TikTok copies elements of Snap, copies elements of YouTube all the time. So everybody copies everybody else, which is particularly interesting if you then think, well, but what about the profitability of these services?
The way I'm thinking about this, I feel YouTube, Instagram, I don't know about Snapchat, but I feel YouTube and Instagram did move fairly quickly when TikTok became extremely dominant. I mean, YouTube introduced YouTube Shorts, yep. I think in 21, if I'm not wrong. Reels was introduced also in 21. Is that fair to say? Or do you think they were slow to move?
No, I think that's fair to say. So, but that's imitation, right? That's just like, oh, we're seeing something. Someone else has success with some other format, some other mechanism, some other feature, some other widget. And then before you know it, everybody offers that same thing, right? But that's in the history of business, this is a really unusual and interesting observation because usually you build successful businesses by building something that is differentiated from the competition, not by fast imitation. Now, what's particularly interesting about that kind of imitation, say if we start with YouTube first, YouTube, because it's so much bigger than in video than all these other platforms, they, I think, have an interest in changing the game where you're competing less on what's the quality of the user experience, and you're competing more on economies of scale, mostly in the relationship with the creators. And so you can look at the YouTube imitation, you can say, well, that's actually really smart because someone else had a great way to create a better customer experience. And, you know, what are the chances that you come up with the next big thing? Probably not that great. So the best thing you can do is like imitate that user experience, but then have much better economics because you have economies of scale in ways that almost no one else has. And so the very generous compensation of influencers, of creators on as part of the YouTube partnership program, that's part of that rethinking competition. And that's really hard for TikTok, right? So TikTok now says, well, actually, you know, they have something that looks roughly similar to us, except they pay people who create content for YouTube in ways that will completely undermine the economics of TikTok. And so it puts pressure on the competitor in a really interesting way. Now, what's fascinating is this is much harder to do for Instagram. And so you sort of see a little bit the back and forth, like they say, oh, and we're going to have, I think at one point in time, Mark Zuckerberg says half of the content that you will see on Instagram is not going to be of people you're connected to, essentially leaving behind the social in social media. And then very predictably, you get a lot of pushback because guess what? Like lots of influencers built really lucrative businesses on the back of the Instagram platform. And so the last thing that they want is that, oh my God, I worked so hard to get 500,000 followers. And now you're telling me these followers are not really going to see my videos because you decide what's visible. And so the Kim Kardashian and others, like the pushback that Instagram got was essentially because influencers and creators are really powerful in the Instagram model. And one of the incredibly beautiful things that TikTok has done is it's kept its platform much more open to new creators. And as a result, no creator is actually all that influential. So you don't, like if TikTok were to make a change tomorrow that is not in the best interest of the creators, you would see much less pushback compared to Instagram. Why? Because no one is actually all that powerful. On Instagram, the most popular influencers, they're incredibly powerful because they're a big part of the business.
So on Instagram, integrating deals. So I have a view on this, and maybe you can just comment on that. Comment on this in the sense that, so I feel like I admired Zuckerberg for the decision that he took to integrate Reels in Instagram. I felt at least the logic that they gave to the public, and I think Adam spoke about this, Adam Mosseri spoke about this, I think in a lot of AMAs, and also I'm not sure if he posted it, and also I think he's spoken about it in podcasts as well, where he was talking about how the industry itself is moving video first, and you know, this is where the industry is going, and if Instagram does not evolve with this, Instagram is going to die. And I actually bought that logic, and you know, I was in favor of, like, you know, I thought it made sense that when the industry itself is moving to something which is video first and maybe short form video first, it does make sense to kind of pivot the app, even though it's a photo sharing app, to mm-hmm. kind of pivot. Mm-hmm. And I thought it made a lot of business sense. So
I completely agree with that. I think that's exactly right. So but it's less, the part that is interesting and hard is less about, do you go from photos to videos? Yes, like the moment everybody is in love with videos, that's probably something you would do. The bigger decision is, do you downplay the content of people you follow? Right? Is there more content in your feed of people that you don't follow in the first place? That is the really big decision that obviously was controversial, and the company itself has gone back and forth a little bit on that decision.
It happens a lot with, I think, Meta, in the sense that with Facebook/Meta, I think when they introduced newsfeed, I think they got a lot of pushback. And but eventually, it seems like whatever Zuckerberg decides does end up prevailing. So I think even at this point, even they have learned the lesson that no matter what they introduce, they will, I mean, Instagram is so huge that no matter what they introduce, they will see some pushback or the other. But I don't know. I think they'll just go through with the decision that they made, I think. I don't know. At least that's the way I think about it. Should we discuss revenue for like business model of these short form videos? Maybe start with TikTok.
Yeah, so I mean, for the time being, the revenue model is ads, obviously. So it's mostly advertising financed. The tension there is mostly around, since the platform is so much dedicated to authenticity, how good are brands at creating really authentic, which I think often means a little less polished content. And I think there, the TikTok teams who talk to brands, their experience is a little mixed, where some brands are really good at that and they can sort of build on this notion of authenticity, and then other brands a little less so. And I think that this comfort with, you know, what is this new style that really gives popularity on TikTok? That is one explanation why advertising prices on TikTok are so much less still than they would be on Instagram. So on a per person that you reach base, they charge a fraction. And part of that has to do with, of course, it's a company in growth mode. And so you don't want high prices to undermine your growth. But also at the same time, the new requirements or the difference in the requirements, the kind of content, the kinds of brand stories that do well on TikTok, that's something that brands need to learn. And as a result, having more attractive advertising prices, of course, helps with that process.
Do you think they've completely changed the way, like, not completely changed, but I mean, do you think they've put a dent in the way that advertising is done on, like, social media platforms? Like, I think one of the slogans that they have is don't make ads, make TikToks. It kind of speaks to that, you know, the way that you present your message to the audience, that has to change. It's not like, you know, you get maybe celebrities or you have a very well-crafted studio session and then you display that ad. I mean, they want to fundamentally, do you think that's happened or?
Yeah, I think that's happened a little bit. I don't know that that's so completely novel. I don't think it's a big revolution in the way marketing works. It's tailored, you know, just like you tailored your marketing messages to different audiences, to different formats, to different channels. So I feel it's that adjustment process that takes a little while for brands to figure out what works and what doesn't work. But it doesn't feel like a big revolution in marketing to me. I sometimes see campaigns that are really amazing and advertise and enticing and, you know, funny and have exactly the right tone for a medium like TikTok. And then I see lots of advertising that is much more clumsy. Probably not, TikTok is not a good home for that kind of advertising. But in the end, that's maybe not so different from other media, where you sometimes see really amazing work. And then, you know, most of the time, most work is sort of average.
If I understood correctly, most of the money that TikTok makes, it makes it from advertisement. I think we touched upon e-commerce as well earlier. So one thing I was curious about, and one number that I kind of recall is, I think the revenues for TikTok in the year 21 were about $4 billion. But I think in the same year, the revenues for Douyin were about $58 billion. I don't know if I'm getting the numbers correct, but it was around that figure. Is the difference mostly due to e-commerce, or am I missing something here?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. I mean, there's the advertising volume, obviously, on Douyin as well. But then e-commerce is the most substantial change.
So I think that's why you were telling, you were talking about how the next evolution for TikTok is also e-commerce. Is that fair?
Yes, I will be very surprised if they didn't try to emulate that, since it's been so successful in China.
But any theories on why they haven't? I mean, 58. I mean, 4 to 58 is a huge. It's a huge difference. Any theories on why they have not yet? I don't know if they've introduced it now, but any theories on why they have not maybe aggressively pursued it?
Not really. I mean, in part, it's there isn't enormous pressure on the company to be profitable today. So you're thinking, like many other platforms, you're in growth mode. In part, you want to make sure that growth remains stable over time. That often means, commercially speaking, you're a little careful. You don't want to overload people with advertising. You want to carefully test e-commerce. Building e-commerce for fulfillment is also complicated, right? Outside, in particular, now you're far away from your home market. And so how exactly you build those capabilities, I think that's a big and long project, and pushing it off, I think, makes perfect sense.
I think on the growth factor, I think they've definitely succeeded on that, in the sense, I think it was the most downloaded app of 2021 and 2022. And I just checked, I think for the first half of 2023, it's still the most downloaded app in the world, I think.
Number one. Yes, that's right. Yes. And of course, that one reason why this matters so much is when you think about all the political pressure for a moment. Like, how is it that given all the political pressure that the app is still around? And the answer is, at least for the US and probably for some of Europe also, oh my God, there's an incredible number of people who are really fond of TikTok. Like, they cannot possibly imagine that, you know, politicians would take TikTok away. And it sort of reminds me of Uber's early days, when it was also unclear, is it legal, is it not legal, will they get in trouble, will they not get in trouble. I remember an incident when New York City tries to shut down Uber. And it was basically, you know, people were basically on the street revolting. What do you mean you take away this incredible service? And I think that's often for companies that operate in a political minefield, for companies that experience political pressures, making sure that you provide the best experience you possibly can for your customers. You might remember how Uber had just incredible subsidies for everyone who took a ride, or in the TikTok case, being very careful with how you change user experience as a result of adding more advertising. Because in the back of your mind, what you're thinking is, like, there's nothing more important than enthusiastic support of the app. Like, really, what the thing that keeps you alive, the reason why it's not, there's technical legal reasons why it's actually not so easy to ban an app like TikTok in the United States. But to a first approximation, every senator or every representative who pushes for the ban of TikTok, you're doing something that is deeply, deeply unpopular with many young people.
When it was banned in India, I really expected the app to kind of not be like the most downloaded app. I thought it would like drop multiple places, at least. I thought it would be in the top 10, but I thought it would like drop significantly from the number one position, but it really did not. And I think that's like the testament to how novel or how addictive or how wonderful the app app is. Yeah.
Yeah. And thank you, VPN, right?
Thank you, VPN. Yeah. Actually, as I used to use it, almost every day after it was banned, but now that there's a little bit too much work, but nowadays I don't open it as much. Now I've kind of gotten used to Reels. I mean, for at least 6 to 8 months after it was banned, I was consistently using the US TikTok, like VPN connected to New York or San Francisco, and used it. So in terms of politics, I think there are two ways of approaching this. One is, I think ByteDance has seen some resistance. I think earlier in the conversation also we discussed about the tech crackdown that has happened in, I think, 2020. But also parallel to that, I think even in the US, we are seeing, and also we discussed how it's already banned in India. So in some geographies, it's banned. In the US, it's creating a lot of issues. I think the TikTok CEO also was called for a Senate hearing. So I want you to take the call in the sense that which do you think you want to touch on, which is more important, like the US, like outside China one, or do you want to focus on the China politics one?
I think in the US, the fate of TikTok, I think to a large extent, depends on what is happening in the US. The model here, I think, is a little bit the model of Huawei. So when the US started to push back against Huawei, in many ways, that limited Huawei's opportunities outside China to a significant extent. And I would expect the same for TikTok. If there were ever, say, a federal ban of TikTok, or if TikTok would have to be sold to an entity that ultimately ends up not being really good at running the platform, I think nothing would be more important than that. And I think the key thing to recognize here, there's sort of two forces pushing at one and the same time. There's one force that is actually quite reasonable. There are important questions about privacy, important questions about addiction, important questions about misinformation to ask in the context of social media. So for instance, you know, should we have a market for geolocation where I can figure out at any point in time where you have been and how you move to a city or wherever you happen to live? I think that's a really great question to ask. And there are very good arguments on either side. So there's an argument that says, no, actually, this is just not information that should be commercially available. And we should do our best to prevent these markets from existing in the first place. And then there's an argument to be said, well, if you freely share your location in exchange for some benefit that you get from the company, maybe that's your right and we shouldn't interfere with that right. So I'm not saying there is like a clear answer. I think there are good arguments on either side. But what is, I think, largely unacceptable is that in the US, we're having this debate now exclusively with respect to TikTok, right? So we, you know, the idea is, oh, if only we shut down TikTok, all of these privacy concerns, all of these things go away. And that's, of course, completely ridiculous. If the Chinese government really wants to launch a big misinformation campaign, it can easily do this via Facebook. It can easily do this via other social media. So I feel there are these really big political questions, and having the conversation is really important and is a really good thing to do. What I don't find particularly productive is that a particular group of politicians, they pretend this is all just an issue that exists in the case of TikTok. And once TikTok is, say, American owned, or once TikTok is no longer doesn't exist anymore, all of these issues will go away. And of course, that's just not true.
I think TikTok has been extremely unfortunate in the sense that in terms of timing wise, it became extremely popular at a time where at a time when tensions between the US and China maybe were at the so it just got caught up in that. I think at one point even President Trump wanted to almost signed or did sign the
that then didn't quite happen. So I think that's exactly right. It plays out against the backdrop of US-China relations. And then, of course, we have to say it's also true that TikTok keeps making mistakes that are sort of unexcusable, right? So the latest news just a few weeks back that there is some social security information that is stored on Chinese servers. I mean, if you know the predicament that you're in, isn't that the first thing that you will make sure that doesn't happen? Or say when two employees accessed information about journalists and so on. So it's not as though that TikTok has like a completely unblemished record. And they have added gasoline to the fire on occasion. But that the fire exists and is so focused on the TikTok issue, I think is definitely not productive. It's not good because it keeps us from having the real conversation, which is, like, how should we actually think about the rights and obligations of citizens vis-a-vis these platforms?
I think there was another controversy where they were tracking American journalists, if I'm not wrong.
And, you know, in the end, they say it's two rogue workers, and maybe true, maybe not true, but that should be priority number one, that these kinds of things cannot possibly happen.
I think that also, final point, which is, I think there has also been some repercussions of this political quagmire per se, in the sense, I think they had hired Michael Eisner, if I'm not wrong, as a CEO back in 2020, but he had to resign when Trump signed the executive order, but then the thing really didn't go through. So I think he resigned for no reason. I mean, if he would have stayed on, he would have probably been the CEO. So that's all from my side. Thank you.
Wonderful. This was a fun conversation. Thanks for inviting me.